Joseph Cooper speaks eloquently about stuttering, and Karen Zanz O'Connor decries what's missing on maps in this July 30th, 2008 edition of the Rooftop Poetry Club podcast. I'm Dennis Reed. Sup?
So thanks, everybody, for coming out again tonight. And again, my apologies for not being on the roof. Next summer, we will be on the rooftop. We have to be, right? So tonight, it's an exciting night of two really good poets here tonight. We have Joseph Cooper and Karen Zanz O'Connor. So we're going to start with Joseph, I guess. And Joseph and I both share an experience because he actually received his MFA from Naropa. Well, I didn't receive an MFA there. I studied there for a summer. It was such a great experience. It's an amazing place. Joseph Cooper's first book, entitled Autobiography of a Stutterer, was published by Blaze Fox in 2007. His work has appeared in numerous journals, including the American, is it Drivel? Drivel Review, Blaze Box, 2K6, Big Game Books, Bombay Gin, Hot Whiskey Press, Small Town, and String of Small Machines. Please welcome Joseph Cooper.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out. This is great. I haven't done this for a while. It's good to get up here and do this. I'm going to be reading selections from my first book, Autobiography. Autobiography, how perfect is this? The speech impediment kicking in of a stutterer. The intention of this text was to create a speech impediment throughout the work. What I did was create a symbol system that I inserted throughout the whole text so that if people actually read the book out loud, they would be forced into a stutter. And this is something that I have experienced the last 17 years of my life, how old am I now, maybe 18 years of my life now, battling through a speech impediment, a speech block, and all of the things that go along with that. So this is the first two chapters of my book, entitled Lip and then Hard Palate, the speech-making mechanisms of the body, of which there are several. Utterance is the incision of thought-wounded sound, engorged with digital friction. Fluency is haphazard architecture. Consequently, his esophagus was in strands, a series of encrypted messages colonized the infrastructure. Conceive mouth's origin. Tongue is microbial. Slick spores. What happens if tongue is wrapped around the circumference of memory? Verses of surreptitious space slipped fervently into body house. Pronoun I is anonymous. Mouthed by impulsion, his lungs were impaled. In secret, unless otherwise indicated, is where error patterns are fused into body parts. Spontaneous recovery is a relatively simple process of mouth packing and sound deadening. Inside his vocal cords is the confession of hearing. Breach any procedural languages. I am increasing my oracular territory by occupying yours. We will probably want to analyze other disconnection patterns in a similar approach. In reference to location, pretend to be a different one. Vestiges of prayer, debunked throat music. Speak through another orifice. Through walls, voices strip down to sound and assess resonance. Victorious in linguistic artifice, tongue streams a bifurcated voltage. I am consciously fearful of the telephone. Wet palms matted, lashes into a liminal surface. conversation with one's self uses offbeat time signatures until an agreement is reached. Forgive my equation. The silences of space are sobbing to avoid confrontation. He considered eradicating the tongue. It had, on occasion, sprung from the mouth like a baby between the legs of a woman. Instructions dissolve, stretched salaciously over pre-language. An 11-year-old tongue hangs from a meat hook. Under the microscope, at the very moment a smile arrived, 3 sentences were cut down the center. Tongue will cunningly assume the disguise of an angel. It opened its mouth and tied me down. Suck the language of your mass discussion. Truth is represented by the scattered syllables of tongue. On the contrary, it has built its own world for itself. A telephone call from a telemarketer caused his tongue to fall cleanly out. The architecture of the mouth seems to be changing. Humankind finds him repulsive. Smegma of gums lushly amused. I was having trouble feeling you in the back of my throat. From the forcible and foul, the howl and gnaw. He pronounced the word parents in a formidable shape, glued by contact cement. They built a fence around the yard when I was 11 and told me it was to keep anything in my imagination from getting out. My tongue turned gangrene for you. He remains the filament of disparate parts. The moment between tonguing and talking is deleted. Recall your purest interpreter. The first performance was a cleaving of lexical morphemes, stained discourse pressed into seconds of self-translation. Resistance is the property of limiting the passage of emerging fiction. We used to take turns in grade school reading passages from our manuals. They heard his voice and erased all translation. Your tongue is a hybrid of bacterial species. Memory is a loose floorboard in the basement. Trespass on necessary muscle. Such tongues are said to be flapping inside a instead of howling. One phonological resonance was a loose tooth harmonica. Arguments demonstrated this ordinary horizontal. You won't feel pain, you'll just bleed. I have a dream where a tongue is strapped down inside my mouth and raped into liquid. Few people possess the desire to talk unfamiliarly. Breast, flesh, closed into subsequent invisibility. Reside in representation as a kind of thief. Teeth clenched together, engine the head. Therefore your former answer was idle, seemed in semi-darkness. Tongue suffered multiple casualties. Whether such unforced discourse really makes a difference has yet to be determined. A machine stutterer is pronounced incommunicable. The gaping mouth can be construed as sentimental. You are the most beautiful pitch. No speaking of this broken thing to others. Is there any strictly material damage? A melodious extended warbling sun? This might be a slip in the structural design. I want absolutely utter and original flaw. Mother was more familiar through gestures. I bite my tongue every time I eat. His tongue was ambushed by silence. The first time I tongued a girl, my jaw was stiff for 3 days, and my tongue ached. Simulated discourse conceptualizes human thought. Instead of fingers on the bathroom door, mouths against linen provide optimum fit allowance. In speech therapy, we were awarded prizes like animals in training. We grow intimate with monsters. Stick your tongue in every hole and indentation. A tongue is tightened or released by torquing the head. Simple languages are trained to the arbitrary real. He imagined pressing his tongue against the grill like a sausage. What he hears is the peripheral velocity of popular memory. He was completely naked in the voice box. His esophagus mated with a preformed eternal thread. It was cut, unspoiled, like a breath of a violet. From where the public is sitting, it is possible to believe that debates do not take place. Full in language, then disappearing all accountable, were questioned, tracked with lip gloss, put into an iron cage, suspended in the air in the center square by a single syllable. You are very easy with words. I am unavailable to deliberate possibility. Tongue is cut where I went. It is necessary to be among patterns, abducted and forced to shed its human mask. Assuming inadaptable surgical pathways, accusation is the footprint of the deliberately numb. Tongue will completely untie with a single pull. I used to slice worms in half with popsicle sticks and watch them wriggle in mistranslation. Replace everything in the room with a guarded prop. His gritted teeth hurled little sounds toward the unexposed. My voice on the record skips. A noun is constructed from bile. Just remember to finish vigilantly. My machine happens under its own volition. Breathe. Let me finish to relax. Try to deep me. Try to finish me deep. Breathe. Take. Relax. To me-ish. To me. Take me. Breathe. To try. Let me. Let breathe. Deep me. Take a breath. Deep breath. Breathe. The ear and tongue conspire against utterance in a measure of cruelty. You are one of the pieces. Words overlooked the trim flesh of the public. If children keep a record of discourse in its purest form, we can degenerate it into a meaningless routine. Simulated discourse is not complicated, but there are techniques that improve its success. My tongue made a large scar in the center of your thoughts. You are saliva electric. For this next section, I'm going to involve a little Kurt Schwitters. If you guys are at all familiar with Kurt Schwitters or not, he is perhaps one of the foremost sound poets that I've studied in my experience. And his most famous poem, Earth Sonata, is a completely sound generated poem, which I believe to be kind of more translated by your own personal interpretation of it. So I would like to interject a little Schwitters into my moment here. hard palate. When saliva transforms to rectal perspiration, rust, inflexible rust, is exposed in mouth rubble. The physical act of speech, the pleasure in its form, the appreciation of its compactness is valuable, even if the fluent content of these feelings seems low. Stutter something sweet. Breathe. Rip strips along the side and cut into angles. His mouth was devoured by voices. A piece of human vocal apparatus is left fluttering between two diseased tongues. Through college, I rarely asked out a girl if her name began with a hard consonant sound or a vowel. Because we all co-articulate according to the same rules, discourse becomes a contrived situation with an enormous number of degrees of freedom. The mouth, soiled by neglect, is compelled to speak under pain of death. Deemed a cry for help, all inhabitants of an open call system have been sealed with wax. A scene is performed under the memory of an inquisitive machine. Putty tongue is unwelcomingly pinkish. The broad, diaphanous hole is being tested for noise-making equipment. He has in his possession a deeper breath. Repeat research with three marbles, four marbles, etc. The length of a passage does not determine how many other passages of the same length exist. He was a pedestrian in the gray matter of voiceless texture. Many people develop some kind of system for dealing with difficulty. They become intimate with each other after swapping patches of tongue. The whole picture at a glance detects any omission. This is a method of control over an undefeatable opponent. Corked orifice, tongue gagged when it was the center of attention. Please bring back the microphone. Our digital interface is mutating. Knowing tongue bites at appearance was a conductor of discourse. The sentimental anguish of tongue assuaged the upper crust of words. I timed my bathroom breaks for when it was my turn to read. A meaning-making utterance in the telephone is heard as heavy breathing. My mouth went to rack and ruin when speaking to her. Saying hello was like trying to scream for help in a dream with your lips folded backward over the scalp, sealed together with cartilage. Breathing with me to imitate the words, incongruity bests a companion of mimicry. Breathe the growled air when consonants back away toward the throat. A dead mouth will articulate a flawless sound effect. Unctuously, I pleaded for a different disability. Take away my hearing, I'll speak in sign. When language is a carcass sinking in the mud, it does not matter how hard you pull. Bring tongue onto the cold concrete floor nights in the basement. Bring tongue to globs of spittle trembling in the corners of chapped lips. Bring tongue, a negative advance to the restrictions of habit. I have kept a journal of suicide letters for my stutter. Tie a string to the doorknob and close firmly. His impediment immediately preceded the conjunction. Tongue echoed a liturgy of domesticated swine. The mouth, held by an executioner, was pulled generously by the tongue until torn austerely from the platform of loose jowls. Consciousness here operates as if it were a machine being turned on and off. I speak quickly that the auditorium falls to puzzle. I was in a classroom doing a presentation when tongue became acrobatic. Corralled in speech therapy class, you and I were intimately lassoed together in a mock dialogue. Misconstrued, shy speech becomes a spluttering mosaic. Would you suck my lungs for a syllable? As a decoration, some people pierce their tongues, inflicting upon themselves a temporary lisp. I have tongues all over my body now, and blisters where the needles chapped. My tongue is moving in your mouth, but all I can think about is the tantrum it threw at the DMV. Shift the object and change the scale. The human species is an involuntary disruption of spasmodic repetition. Collect butchered syllables in the chub of your cheeks. I am in your mouth, doing all the right things. Tongue, taste your tonguing. Lick obstruction clean from the gum, ingesting you. I bury my tongue in the stretch of your mouth, bitten with nuisance. Twitching his leg below the table, he thinks about tonguing a girl for the first time. There is no reason why a child should not develop schematizations of his own based on operations of his choice. He remembers rumors of a girl in school masturbating with a banana when it broke off inside her, and wonders if his tongue is at risk. Our concern is with a development of a schematization for some children who we feel socially to be valuable, but here is not the place to discuss this link. A man holding a telephone is startled at what he is hearing. An amplifier births a dropped jaw. Don't answer is discussions now banished from our secondary school textbooks. I order my meal based upon the simplicity of its sound. I will have salami on wheat. I do not want tomatoes, but the sound is too hard to utter. It is no longer your body, fleshy and spectacular. The tongue will wiggle around and shiver when dismembered. It's such a pity. I watched it thump the ground once when it was denied a taste of mango. Sometimes I would masturbate before making a phone call to release tension. The head plus suction, lift and friction loss. Anticipating my turn to speak, I peel back another cuticle. The snicker in the back corner sounds like highway construction. Translate binary code into high-level languages. Almost any situation calling for an inductive response can be treated. Fums baba tsetse! Bogus gui. Drbebo, drbebo fums bo, drbebo fums bo, bebo fums bo ota, bo fums bo ota za, fums bo ota za, fums bo tetse, bogif qui. Disney nrlim pif tilif tu, tilejuka. Rinzeke be be nze karamu, ziu nze ziu rinze karamu, rakete be be, rumpf telef tu, ziu nze ziu rinze karamu, ziu nze ziu rinze karamu, rakete be be, rakete be ze. Fumsbauer Tetze Uzi Tiwi Bi Fums. My father told me that he stopped finishing my sentences when he could no longer predict what I was going to say. My father told me what I was going to say when he could no longer stop finishing my sentences. I told my father that when he predicted my sentences, to stop finishing what he could no longer say. Stop finishing, my father, I was going to say, when he stopped predicting what he could. When he could, what I was going to say, my father's sentences no longer predicted stopping. My father, I was going to finish when stopping saying longer sentences he predicted told. Longer predictions were going to finish my father before I stopped my sentences, goings, and sayings. What he could no longer predict, I told my father to stop. I was going to predict my father. My sentences stopped. I finished what he could no longer say. I was going to say my sentences. What was I going to predict? When was my father saying that he stopped? I told me to say, my father was going. I told me that he predicted my stopping. I predict my sentence. I sentence my saying to a longer finish. Thank you.
Okay, so Karen. Karen Sands O'Connor's poetry career began in fourth grade, I love this, when she wrote a now buried book of poetry for her school's Young Authors Program. There's a story there, I think, on pink paper, no less. Her first publication, however, came decades later with a birthday poem she wrote for a Bob Dylan fan and dear friend. Did you bring that tonight?
I did.
Yes. She has been published in the British Journal, Orbis, and in the Journal of Caribbean Lit, and has had poetry readings at the Birchfield Penny in Buffalo and the Liverpool Poetry Cafe in the UK. So, Karen, please welcome Karen Sands O'Connor.
All right. You know, it's funny, I was telling my family that I was going to read with a former student of mine, and I have to say that I didn't remember that you stuttered. What I remembered about you was your clear, precise writing. So obviously your tricks worked. They worked on me anyway, so. The poetry I'm going to read today, a lot of it is poetries of various journeys, and I'm going to start out with a poem that I wrote about my great-grandmother. My relatives are from Poland. They came over, and actually had this happen a couple weeks ago in Spain. They were taking pictures of me as I was speaking, and I kept losing my place. So I'm obviously not ready for the limelight, but anyway, my great-grandmother actually ran away from home when she was 14 years old, and she ran away from Poland and came to America. So I like to think of myself as her aunt's descendant. That's a good question. Actually, she just thought America would be terribly, terribly exciting, and so she ran away. But she came to live in Detroit, where I was also born and grew up, and she lived in a part of Detroit called Pole Town. And when she got older, General Motors, I don't know how many of you know this, but General Motors took over the area of Pole Town and got the government to say that GM could knock all the houses down. And so people either had to accept GM's paltry offer of recompense or they had to just stay there, and some of them did. So anyway, this poem's called Motor City. I tried to find a map of Pole Town. Maps never show the things that matter. Buttercups in her backyard, the $5 she handed out at Christmas and Easter with Coke and cashews. Maps are for driving, and she came here to find her way, brand new and all-American, like Ford's assembly line. Making a home was her mistake. You can't stand still in the Motor City. You can't stop industry on the move. She willed her own death rather than sell up and out. She knew another kind of Supreme Court. She knew another law of eminent domain. The church where all her children, baptized, married, buried their dead, refused alliance with Mammon, but suffered the same fate. There's nothing left of her now, back of Automation Alley is a brick wall and two committed socialists speaking Cantonese. But you keep driving along St. Aubin, Shane Street, Joe Campau, because maps don't mention the next to get lost. My husband's ancestors are... ancestors, not that far back. My husband's mother is Jamaican, and some of my research has been on the ways that British writers depicted West Indians in literature. And so we went to Jamaica while I was doing research, and I wrote about the roads in Jamaica because I found the whole system of transport fascinating when I was there. The first thing that you learn about Jamaican roads is that when you fly into Jamaica, you are supposed to contact a JUTA man. And JUTA stands for Jamaican Union of Transport Authority or something like that. And these were the only legal cab drivers in all of Jamaica. So you weren't supposed to go with anybody else. And they told you in the guidebooks how much they would charge you. And you get there, and of course they charge you like $10 and $20 and $40 more. So this first poem is about the JUTA man. These next three poems are actually coming out in the Journal of Caribbean Lit. So, JUTA man. The JUTA man is anonymous. He owns something more than a name. JUTA man has a P on his van announcing his power. The JUTA man is priceless, naming his fee without blinking, despite what the guidebook suggests, knowing we will come back. The JUTA van is careless of speed, of economy, of visible humanity along the dark-teamed coast where roads can disappear. And so could we, maybe. Well, after that experience, which was frightening, we decided we wanted to go down to the beach one day. And of course, according to the guidebooks, you're not supposed to go down to the beach alone. You wouldn't want to cross those roads. And after being in a JUTA van, I definitely did not want to cross the roads because you never know when somebody's going to come racing around the corner. So we went down. We were staying in a town called Port Antonio, which used to be the home of Errol Flynn, if you know who that is. So it's sort of a down-at-heel, we were once a tourist town kind of place. But that's where we were staying. And so we asked the front desk clerk to call us a taxi. And she did, and this is what happened. Jamaican Transport to Winston. Winston, not his real name, and his Ford, not his real car, picked us up at the behest of the sharp-tongued Jamaica Palace front desk clerk, even though the owner, a German, scowled and told her to call a proper taxi. We could see what he meant. After all, it's not every day you get a chance to ride in a car built by Noah in case of a good picnic spot down the road when the floods receded, in a car held together mostly by cardboard. But despite the lack of restraint in seats and paint job, desert camouflage in the middle of the rainforest, despite the windows that stayed up or down as they saw fit, or the time he came to get us and then promptly ran out of gas, this laid-back, vaguely shuffling, balding man who made me hide when the police came along because white girls shouldn't be driving around in the back of a car like that in a ghost tourist town like Port Antonio, Winston yet inspired confidence. Or perhaps comfort is a better word. He did call Gwenny my little friend, and once he realized we were his first ever repeat customers, he got brown towels to cover the holes in the back seat, and always came on time, a minor Jamaican miracle. Maybe we, in fact, inspired confidence in him, because when he drove us halfway up the mountain, only to find they wouldn't let us in the caves because the three of us were not a cruise ship, Winston swore and yelled at the owners in patois while we huddled in the car. And then again, when he drove us through to Kingston, across the mountains 3 hours, fortified by only a few of my cashews, and promptly got lost in the urban bustle, he stopped the car bang in the middle of the road and asked every chief or mate for directions. Then suddenly we were there and got out and unloaded, Gwen pulling on me, anxious for the pool. I started moving toward the lobby when I heard him laugh and say, "Kids." And only then realized I hadn't said goodbye. And the last one is actually about the roads in Jamaica, which are deserving of a poem in themselves. Jamaican Transport 3, Roads. Jamaican roads for Jamaican people, they rumble, here I am, breaking down, breaking the backs of my people. Jamaican roads for European bananas, they grumble, why should we have to pay and pay so much for the fruits of our past? Jamaican roads for Kuwaiti bauxite, they say nothing at all, but you can hear the hissing laughter as you drive. So, those are some actual trips that I have taken, or people in my family have taken, but I think there are other kinds of trips that we take that we don't always think of as trips. And the next couple of trips that I'm going to take through poetry, one is just, it relates to a former life. I've had several of them, former lives. And I once wrote a textbook on the kinetic molecular theory for sixth graders. I don't know, it was something to do, so. When I did that, you know, I learned a lot about, I actually knew nothing about the kinetic molecular theory until I wrote this textbook, and so, but things come together for me in funny ways, and I think my mind takes journeys that go beyond sometimes the places, the actual places I go. So I read Goethe's Elective Affinities, if any of you have ever read that. I was feeling in that German romantic sort of mood. And when I was reading it, I was actually thinking of molecules. So this poem comes from a journey of the mind. It's called Electron Affinities. Last time we touched, you said nothing, your smile all Truffaut Moreau, but you left your electrons surrounding me with your kiss. A shining cage enclosing my egg of possibility, a tourbillon reconfiguring the effect of gravity. Every need denied compels to faith, and I feel the common prayer of those shocking particles, pensive in their patterned dance, singing you, encircling me, outside the confines of the chronotopiary, inside the weight of mind's flight. And you may notice that there's a reference to the movies in there. I like the movies. Movies are fun. And actually, I tend to like old movies. And one of the movies, I like cowboy movies. And one of the movies that I watched recently was the last movie that both Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe ever made. And after I watched it, I had a dream. And so this is about that journey I took in the dream. It's called Intimations. We met at the movies. I wore a yellow ribbon so you could recognize my disease. Yellow was your color, too. I wasn't sure you'd come. We stayed all day watching Gable ride out the last roundup, watching Monroe fade into light of common day, star searching. You said that film never was called The Immortals, but in dark days I dreamed of our day in the dark, believing that misfit, time forgot love. And speaking of cowboys, I took a trip with my little brother, oh gosh, years ago now. I was 18, 19, and we went across the whole country and came back. And if you've ever done that, and I highly recommend it, right about Nebraska, you start getting billboards for wall drug. And you think to yourself, well, I would never stop and go to a drugstore. Why is that considered a tourist attraction? And then you go farther and farther, and as you realize that you are, the world is emptying out. There is nothing there except Wall Drug. And then you end up there. So I did go to Wall Drug on this trip. It was actually quite exciting. And so this comes out of the time I had at Wall Drug, where I nearly made us homeless and bankrupt. So it's called Overdrawn. The West is as big as its myth, with its back against the Wall Drug. A mechanical cowhand stretches out, sensing my presence. Howdy, partner. The cliched wide-open aspect shadowed by looming thundercloud threat. Think you can outdraw me? Put in a quarter and see. I did, and did, and did not. And did, and did, and did not again, more times than I can count. The whole history of Horace in my quarter-staff struggle, hopeless against the machine. I knew I ought to get out of Dodge, but instead, in desperado desperation, a less than two-bit Annie Oakley, I knocked over a one-armed bandit with my last buffalo and watched the limp, limp, limp of $30 in nickels spitting into my lap. So that was exciting times, those. This next poem is actually inspired by the trip that I took just recently. I went to take some graduate students abroad, and we were in the UK, and we went to Liverpool, and I was working with another colleague in our department, Jennifer Ryan, and she, on her book list, which we read each other's book list, she had the Liverpool poets, and I don't know if you've ever read the Liverpool poets, but I hadn't, and so it was exciting to get introduced to them. And if you have, then you know that they're interested in comics. And so in honor of them, I wrote this. This is more of a ditty, I think, than a poem, but that's all right. It's called Superman Man. Superman Man, Wonder Woman's sister, why don't you tell me how you do it? Whenever I take the invisible jet out for a spin, leap tall buildings on my way to work, Homeland Security restricts my passport. So, I've had another journey this past year, one that I don't think anybody wants to take. I've spent a lot of time in the hospital this past year. And as I said, it's not a journey anybody wants to take, but I especially hate it because those of you who know me will know that I'm extremely impatient as a person. And so going to the hospital is not fun for somebody who's really impatient and wants to get things over with, get things done, and have answers and control. So I'm not a very good patient. And this sort of hit home with me when I was in the hospital. I was down at Gate Circle actually having one of 9,000 tests that I was having, and I was stuck. Gate Circle is a hospital that is filled, at least in the part where I was, with people who are over the age of 65, and I was the only person who was not, and so it was very tense for me. But this is called Patience. The snap of my book shutting belies a pasted smile. I hate the old ladies. The old men, they stare or sniff their shame at breaking down. But look up at the old dears once, just once, and Granny is off and running the mile-a-minute race toward death. Not just this one, the pains, the pills, but the time before, the sprains, the spills, when she came through okay, and also her sister, the aches, the ills, and her husband, who died, oh, 3 years back now, married for 40, the wake, the will. My fingers tap a hopeful obituary to this conversation, which she reads all too well. Looks down at the tubes, the needles, the confining chair. I take advantage and bend my head, but I can still see her fingering those tubes. Her voice quiet now. I shouldn't talk so. No, I'm lucky, yes. My littlest granddaughter, only 26, and she... The sentence hangs, so I reach up reluctantly to catch her eye once, just once. Her pity, unexpected, resting on my needles, my tubes, my confining chair. I shouldn't talk so. No. While I was in England, we went to Kew Gardens because I had made them read Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf wrote a short story called Kew Gardens, where she basically records everything that happens in half an hour or so. And so I made the students all do this, and I created all kinds of evil and exciting journal entries for them to do. And I didn't do any of them, except for this one. I did sit and watch the people go by in Kew Gardens. And I haven't seen their efforts yet, so I'm sure that all theirs are much better than mine. But this is what I wrote in Kew Gardens. It's called Orangery, because I was sitting in the orangery. The hour of prams and pensioners. Hello, little sausage. Hello, pet. Emily, come here. Emily, come back. Emily Rose, you come back here now. A woman in Florida colors, eyes hidden by her white bucket hat, looks up and turns the page of her book with a single manicured nail. The keeper with a struggling limp won't use a wheelchair, won't take a cane. Battle of Britain, commended by a king, battles crabgrass and black beetles now. Reassured by his gentle young colleague as to the quarter-inch length of the grass, while the eyeless woman shifts angles to catch a different sun. Shiny and sun-skinned Italians, hard-waxed lemons on a damson tree, lover-like knees and fingertips, shoulders and mouths all sour disdain, continental contempt of coffee efficiently tapped out of paper packets by the woman whose eyes are never revealed as she sets aside her book. I was in Japan last year, and I was there for a conference, but actually was staying with an ex-student of mine, Ted Grinowitch, who got both his undergraduate and his graduate degree here. And one night he took me to a temple so that I could see it, called Fushimi Inari, which means foxes and gates. And it was closed, and yet it was open, because temples are never really closed, but all the people had gone away. And so what you saw when you went up to it was this giant forest of red poles and little stations where people would write their prayer on a fox-shaped triangle, and then eventually they burn all those triangles and send the wishes up to Buddha or God or whoever, whoever's listening, I guess. And so this is the poem that comes from that time. It's called Fushimi Inari. Temples like children scattering over mountains, meant to be seen and not heard. So say tourist buses, tea houses, trinket sellers, tripod toters, the merchants of daylight praise. But foxes come out in the dark, slip through gates as moonlit prayers. We too, nocturnal hunters, the scarlet forest, a dim canopy all around, noses twitch with sharp tang of varnish and the memory of incense. Silent the pilgrims' wish-bank shrines, pregnant with Reinhardic petition. Our ears now open to unsunned sounds, the holy bell choir of crickets and water, the haw-haw laughter of crows, the clack-talk singing ring-gong, calling out my prayer for you. Okay. When I was giving my, doing my poetry reading in Liverpool, it was actually my friend's birthday, the same friend who I wrote my first published poem for, which I'll read at the end. But this was this year's poem. He gets a poem every year. I think probably for him it's a sort of a dubious gift, really, too, because that's all he gets is a poem for me. And it's kind of like saying it's all his fault that I am a poet, and I'm not sure how he really feels about it. But in any case, because it was his birthday and because I was in Liverpool, I was obviously thinking about the Beatles, and he was turning 63 this year, so that made me think more about the Beatles. And actually, 1963 was the year before the Beatles came onto the scene. It was late 1963 when the Times of London actually said, hey, this is a band that you might want to check out. So it seemed appropriate that I would write a poem that dealt with the Beatles and with him turning 63. And also, while I was researching the poem, because, you know, it's me, so I have to do research on everything, I found out that Penny Lane is named after a man called Captain James Penny, who was a slave trader and who actually went to Parliament in the 1800s and told Parliament that the slaves were quite happy on his ship, and they were dancing as they came to and fro. So all was well, and the slave trade should go on. This is why I say this is a dubious gift for my friend, because this poem is either about him or about Paul McCartney and John Lennon or about Captain James Penny or about neither or both, because that's the way poems are. All right, it's called 63. A year on the edge of the times changing, of the world wanting to hold your hand. You never lied, just shed your past with a tomcat's charming, disarming disdain. The future you imagine, trimmed with Valentine love, wine bottle validation, nothing's gonna change that world. But your friend, the poet, always played a minor key. Push that edge a world away from your blue suburban eyes. You testified everybody danced to your tune. And we all lie, les pieds devant, when bound for glory. Bleed the bloody past, silver tongues to silver wings. No poet yet born could smell something fishy sticking a finger in your pie. An edgy year, time had changed you, unjustly leaving you just the same. You saw a film today, oh boy, it looked exactly like the life you had. Grandchildren on your knee, 64 coming, without birthday greetings or profound whatever, from your friend, the poet, who had long since left you your future and your storied past. Okay, I'm going to finish up with the last, the first poem I ever had published, which is also a birthday poem for my friend. A little more cheerful than the last one. So this was published in Orbis, and I had a request for it, so I said I would read it. It's called Even Bob Dylan Falls in Love. And it's about my daughter in part, so I'm glad that she's here to hear it. Gwen, she, man, she, wouldn't, couldn't, can't she, won't love anyone who isn't worth it. And damn, she loves Bob Dylan at the top of her lungs. Me, I'm the sap kind, yellow-bellied seersucker, too kind. That love seems worth less. But my heart made Ginsberg laugh from his pot belly once. Alan, Dylan, howl y'all crawl through love's back garden, but even still can sing it sweet. Think of my smile now, and honey, Gwen sends a kiss. Thank you very much.
Rooftop Poetry Club is a service of E.H. Butler Library at Buffalo State College. Our website is www.buffalostate.edu/library/rooftop. Go there to see what's coming up on our calendar, to find info about joining, to read member bios, and to connect to our excruciatingly thorough archive of past projects and photos. Thanks to our performers, to Lisa Forrest, and to Buffalo State's instructional resources for technical assistance. And thanks again to you for listening. We'll see you next time up on the roof.